I'd like to speak this evening about spiritual vision. What it means to aspire to the greatest potential of our human existence, our human birth. And it's a useful question to ask ourselves when we're engaged in spiritual practice. What is our aspiration? What is it that we're here for? At the heart of it all. These teachings and the remarkable lineage of women and men and beings who have practiced these teachings speak to us of the possibility of freedom. Liberation for the welfare, for the benefit of all beings. Do we trust this is possible for us? Do we have a sense of faith, of confidence, of belief? Even if we don't quite know how, or even what that might look like, do we have some sense of this possibility, this potential? I think it's really important that we ask ourselves this question. We can sometimes rather easily, I think, and unfortunately rather, perhaps sadly even, come to settle for somewhat less, to just be a little more comfortable, a little more ease. And hey, what's not to like about that? But so much more is possible for us. The Buddha himself, in his own journey, when he was not yet awakened, when he was still seeking, he at some point in himself came to a place where he realized that this sense of possibility was something he had to turn towards and place at the center of what he was engaged with. And he sat down under the Bodhi tree. He made a resolution to himself. He said, I will not move from this seat. I will not move from this place until I have realized what can be realized by human endeavor. Until I have understood what can be understood by human endeavor. He said, I will not move from this place, from this seat. Though my blood runs dry, though my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this place until I have understood what can be understood, realized what can be realized by human endeavor. And it seems to me both an incredibly inspiring and powerful utterance that a human being could make that commitment. I will stay here. And it expresses a confidence also, a sense of possibility. We need to have the sense of possibility. It doesn't mean we are, as of this point, going to say, okay, I'm not moving. Me and this cushion, we're staying together, just like this. The spot in which we sit is the orientation of our heart and our life. That's where our seat is, not the physical location. And yet that degree of clarity and focus and directionality is essential. Ultimately, we need to have this. Now, what's interesting in the story of the Buddha, and many of you know, even I think Catherine might have referred to it the other day, a little bit of this. But what happened as he made that commitment, as he sat down with that sense of absolute, this is what my life is now about. Nothing else. This is what it's about. It is told, and the Buddha recounted, the emergence then of what he described as Mara, who in mythological terms was the embodiment of ignorance, of greed, of hatred, of all the things, including death, that human beings struggle with. And in a mythological sense, archetypical sense, embodied as a being, one could equally understand it as a a psychological manifestation of what that kind of commitment might evoke from us. Because if we say that firmly, what we might notice arising is the response that Mara appeared and said, "What right have you got to be sitting on that seat? What right have you to claim enlightenment?" There's a bit more to the story, but that's the piece I'm picking up here. And the Buddha's response, as Catherine mentioned the other night, he reached out and touched the earth to bear witness to his right to be sitting there, his right to have said, the validity, the appropriateness of saying, "This is what my life is about." And he touched the earth, and it said that the earth shook in an expression of affirmation. It was palpable, it could be felt. Now, whether literally the earth shook, according to the more mythological version, or whether actually the potency, the vitality of the Buddha's connection to the earth and to life. And you see these images in various places. He touched the earth, and the earth responded. It's like out of that opening to that doubt, if one does so, it's not a personal right of just me, and because I've been good or I've worked hard, but it's something shared, it's something mutual, it's something that includes. When we include our connection to everything, it is something unstoppable ultimately. And we see these pictures and images, and in Bodh Gaya, the village in India nearby where this actually took place 2,500 years ago, and where there is a tree which is in fact the grandchild of the tree that was there at the time 2,500 years ago. There are images, large images, small images, thousands of images of the Buddha, and the Buddha touching the earth. So for me, this talk and this reflection is about what it means for us as human beings, as followers on the path, as seekers, as explorers, to touch the earth, to find that trust, that confidence, and that connection in and through ourselves in relationship to our life and all of life. So again, the question can be asked, you know, what are we here for? What are we here for? Not to judge or to marginalize the many different important aspirations and urges that bring us here. There are many. And I think pretty much all of them will be good. And yet it's important that we do not limit them. As the Buddha himself once said, the reason for my teaching, for this holy life, it's not to have gain or honor or renown as the benefit, or the attainment of virtue or concentration for its benefit, even knowledge and wisdom as its goal. No. The unshakable deliverance of mind, the sure heart's release, this is the fulfillment of the holy life. This is the reason for my teaching. Its completion. Its heartward. So what would it be for us in our engagement here, working with whatever we're working, developing whatever we're exploring or needing to engage with, to have a sense alongside of that, that there's something possible for us as human beings, that there is a potential we have, a capacity that is inherent in what we are, to wake up. And that this very moment we're in is a moment in which this could be possible. In fact, this is possible. Because it will never be something from another moment. It will always be in the moment that we're in. It can only be in the moment that we're in that we discover anything. So I think there's a really important process that this brings forth for us. In that turning towards being invited, perhaps encouraged, maybe it might feel like challenged, to consider, well, where am I with all of that? Where am I with all of that? Because it might be, yeah, you know, that sounds kind of good for the serious ones, or maybe if you're going to shave your head and put on a brown robe, maybe that might be the kind of thing, but that's not how the Buddha saw it. It's not how the Buddha taught it. It's not how it's been transmitted down through the generations of living practitioners like yourselves and myself. This is possible for each and every one of us. But we hear our mind say, maybe not me. And so we might think, you know, I need to sort myself out first, surely. Figure out all my stuff, work out my history, you know, let go of all those sort of patterns and habits that I've developed in order to deal with the complicated and painful things that happened to me along the way. Don't I need to sort that out first? And of course we do need to attend to that. We do need to take care of that. There's something profound, beautiful, and a real blessing we bring into life, our life and all of life around us, as we understand and transform those constructs, those patternings, those different, we call sankharas, sort of formations that have been built up in habitual and unconscious ways that limit and bind us. Absolutely. And there's real freedom and real blessing that we know and that we can offer others as we understand, as we unpack them. We also support each other to be able to understand and unpack all of those things. So yes, that is an essential part of the path. But it's easy to kind of make that where our focus becomes primary. Or to kind of have the sense, yeah, I'll do that first. I'll get finished with all of that first. And actually, there is no end to all of that. Sorry, I know, this might not be good news. There is always more to unpack in the realm of that which has got packed together and could do with some unpacking. And even when it's really unpacked, you actually start to notice that, wow, that's a lot of space, but we could unpack that a bit more. Some of you will have had these experiences, and you might even have said, oh, I've unpacked that piece. It's unpacked, it's done with. And then some point later you realize, oh, there's a bit more of unpacking. It goes a bit further. And it always goes a bit further, actually. But there's a way in which we can get caught or trapped in a process of what we could describe as rearranging the furniture in our prison cell. Maybe we're even redecorating the walls, but we're still trapped inside. Maybe we've even got to knocking down a few walls and, you know, reorganizing, we're rebuilding this thing, but we're still inside. There's still some way in which our limit, our vision and our experience and our understanding is constrained by the framework that we're operating out of. And so, to just contemplate the possibility that maybe this isn't a linear thing that we're engaged with here. Our mind tends to think in terms of linear dimensionality, distance from here to there, time from now till then. Those things, those ways that our mind thinks, are a reflection of a particular way of conceiving and understanding that always suggests things happen one after another in a sort of a directional unfoldment and need to be organized in that way. But in fact, and there's a lot could be said about that, but in the context of what I'm speaking to here, what we need to understand that linearity is just one way we can understand what's happening. And it's not like there's something that has to happen first before something else can happen. Or something that won't be able to happen if something else happens first. Do you follow? It's not limited. It's not that there's just one pathway and we all better line up behind each other and follow. That's one of the things you also see in spiritual traditions. We get the sense of, well, we've all got to do it the way the teacher did it. Actually, I don't think any of us do it the way anybody else ever did it. And the Buddha very clearly had a whole range of different responses to different people according to what they needed and where they were and what might help them. He didn't have just the same answer for everybody. So we could just maybe usefully think or reflect about some of the ideas that we have. I think these are really common, but they're not always conscious. We haven't always thought them through, even named them, brought them out and looked at them to say, oh, Do I believe this? So one of the ideas is that, and this is maybe a more classic Asian idea, but we might have a sense of it. It's like, I've got too much karma, you know, or, you know, I've done so many things in my life and I'm going to have to sort out the mess I've made, surely, before anything else is going to happen. Or the mess that somebody else made while I was there and I ended up stuck with. Surely I have to sort that out first. It's interesting looking into the texts and the recordings of the Buddha's teachings where, like, in one place he talks about receiving the fruit of his own karma. And he's at this point fully enlightened Buddha. As far as we know, this guy has really understood, profoundly transformed and penetrated the depths of all things. And it's like he's saying, oh yeah, you know, once in the past I was really mindless and hurt somebody. And as a result of that, at a certain point in my life, he's explaining what happened, because he was walking without shoes, stood on a sharp rock, it jabbed him in the foot and cut his foot quite badly, so it was bleeding. And he said, oh, yeah, this was actually a result of a time in the past where I was careless, caused someone else to hurt themselves. And they get a little bit literal, these stories. I'm not sure it's exactly that literal. But the key part of it is there was a mindlessness and a disregard for the impact of what he did when he was young, he said. And so here it happened to me that I was mindless in that moment and hurt myself. And he said, and I experienced painful, racking feelings. That's the language of the term. You think, ouch, it hurts. He's not beyond that. Freedom, liberation, awakening isn't that my foot doesn't hurt if it gets cut. Isn't that my past may not have an effect in my future. It does, still. That process doesn't come to an end. And of course, there's the story of Angulimala. Maybe you've known about or heard of the he's kind of like the bad guy of the Buddhist stories. He was someone who had apparently killed 999 people and wore their fingers around his neck. Anguli is finger, mala is necklace. He was a fearsome character, and when the Buddha came into his the forest where he was practicing his horrific deeds, he wasn't able to harm the Buddha, and he became curious about the Buddha because he couldn't catch up with him. There's a whole story there, but the key thing was that the Buddha spoke to him in a way that he could hear, and he stopped and he woke up and he was free, and he'd killed thousands of people, hundreds of people. It's a very interesting thing to contemplate, isn't it? Gosh, you know, I've done a few things I feel a bit embarrassed about, and some things which really might have hurt some people, but I haven't got that close, actually, to that. Maybe that isn't going to be a bar or a limitation. Now, it's said that when he went walking through the villages as a monk in the robes and, you know, radiant, awakened, they would throw stones and rotten vegetables at him. Because they didn't know. They thought, this is the guy who, you know, killed all those people. He had some result of his action. Came to him. Karma. Continues to bear its fruit. But the process of awakening cut right through that. So this isn't to say we don't need to really take care about our actions. Of course we do. And it's not in any way to condone the behaviour of a murderer. No, that was truly harmful, horrific and tragic. But so far as we imagine that what we have done in the past, our karma or what we might imagine makes us bad, is somehow a bar here. No. We may need to learn from it and through it. Yes, in fact, not may. We do need to learn from it and will learn through such things. But the kind of, oh, no, that's not for me because of what I've done in my life already. Sorry, doesn't wash, doesn't go. Yeah. It's not any real basis we could say to support the idea that this awakening, this realization that the Buddha points to, that the teachings invite us to know for ourselves, that this is somehow not for me, not for oneself. There's a story where the Buddha encounters another spiritual practitioner from the Jain tradition. And the Jains are actually quite a beautiful spiritual tradition and have some really remarkable commitment to causing no harm in the way they live their lives. But in the Buddha's, in the stories from the Buddha's time, the founder of the Jains, Mahavira, was a contemporary of the Buddha. And they kind of become a bit the fall guys. They get used to sort of show how bad and silly they are, which is a little unfortunate aspect that comes out of religious traditions. But at the same time, sometimes some really useful teaching. And one of the things we sort of think is that, gosh, given what I've done in my life, I've got to probably go through a lot of suffering and pain to kind of get free. That somehow we have this idea that I will purify myself by going through lots of difficulty. It's quite a deeply rooted idea we can have. And so again, when I raise this, it's not that I'm assuming or telling you that you have this, but to be able to ask and see, oh, is there some way I've imagined, for instance, that the difficult things of my life were because something wrong with me, and therefore I need to have lots of difficulty, as though somehow that's required, that I must go through more pain in order to somehow come out the other end of it. We may need to work with our ability to open to and handle and skillfully receive and engage the impact and the effects of those experiences. Yes, that is part of our journey. We speak to that and we honour that. And again, if we make that process somehow a precondition or a requirement to be fulfilled or completed prior to the realization of our potential as human beings, we miss something. So there's the story of where the Buddha encounters a Jain monk, and the Jain is standing on one leg. This is the kind of thing they did. And still in India you can find practitioners who will be doing things like that for days, weeks, months, even years, standing on one leg. You know, 15 minutes standing on two legs? That's quite a while. You think one leg. You think one day, 2 days, 1 week. Whoa, hard work. Commitment, the required. Ooh. So something to respect there. But the Buddha asks the Jain, you know, so he sees and he says, sir, very respectful, sir, what are you doing? He says, I'm purifying my karma through experiencing these painful feelings from standing on one leg. I'm purifying my karma. He says, the Buddha's response was, oh, okay. So do you know how much karma you've purified so far? And the Jain said, no, I don't actually. And he said, okay, so do you know how much karma you've got to go? How much is still to be purified? He says, no, I don't actually. He says, how will you know when you're finished? And the Jain said, I don't know. He said, and so the Buddha went on and said, well, actually, you know, it doesn't work quite like that. And in that same way, we may notice that idea that we have, and it's a little bit like the no pain, no gain that Catherine mentioned previously. This idea that somehow what we are isn't yet enough. And what it is that we are needs to be somehow fixed or transformed or passed through some kind of fire of suffering. As if that was the price of entry. And yet, well, there's something true to that, because we have to be willing to meet the suffering that's here. Absolutely. We can't get away from having to meet it. But it's to go too far to think that somehow the fact of it being here is the point in itself. As if going through more of it gets us somewhere. Does that make sense to you? It might not. And actually, it's okay if it doesn't. Perfectly okay to be confused or unsure sometimes.
Does that help?
Maybe it's easier if I pull this. If you've got a light behind me. Is that easier? How's that? It's about as much as we're going to get unless I put it down here. I don't think so. Huh? How's that? Is that better?
No.
Is it better for you? No? Okay. So, we have this easily unnoticed or unquestioned sense of me that somehow in a process, in a journey, in a spiritual journey, we could say, or a life journey, we could say, and there's something very real and true about that. There is a journey going on. There is a journey going on. And yet how we understand what it is that's happening. This is something we need to be asking ourselves. You know, how am I understanding this? How am I understanding what's going on? We can easily look inside and see all these things that seem confused, reactive, greed, hatred, envy, jealousy, impatience, irritability, selfishness, not caring at times about things that we actually realize are important, but just sometimes I just don't care. And we look in here and we think, gosh, I have to sort all that out, don't I? Shouldn't I? Mustn't I? Doesn't that seem to be what would make sense here? And of course we need to care about all of this, but that might not actually be quite as we conceive it, what we're seeing here. So there's a story from the tradition of the Chan lineage, which is the Chinese precursor to Zen and still exists as Chan in China, which became Zen in Japan, more sort of well known in at least the regular world, and Soan in Korea. And the story of one of the ancestors, I could say, the great teachers of the Chan lineage, sometimes also called the ancestors of the Zen tradition. One such being was Hui Ning. Hui Ning was a simple person. But on one occasion he had opportunity to hear a few words of teaching from one of the suttas. I don't actually remember in this moment exactly what that teaching was, but I think it was pretty good because he understood something. And I think it might have been one of the teachings he heard was just that the teaching we've talked about, all that arises is subject to passing. I think it was that one, but there was maybe a little bit more in it that he heard. And he understood something, and so he made his way to a monastery, but he was a simple village person. He wasn't educated. He couldn't read or write. He got a job. You know, they were happy. They got him in the kitchen, in the kitchen peeling potatoes. That's what they thought he would be good. You know, so he's helping the spiritual work of the monastery. But he had quite a lowly status. And at this time, the abbot of the monastery, who was a highly realized and deeply respected meditator and very wise and revered leader, he was aging and dying, and he knew his time was near. And he wasn't sure if any of his students, which of his students he should give the transmission of authority, the robe and the bowl, which would mean they would be the next abbot of the monastery. So he thought, I'll have a competition to see which of my students is the wisest. It's the sort of thing that makes you feel good and relaxed, isn't it? You know, let's test them all and see who's the wisest and most realized. We don't do that so much in our tradition. It's more common than that. We test them out and check them out. I find it makes people less actually realized than they would be if we didn't do that. So there we are. Anyway, here's this competition that's set up, and all the monks
And it is all monks in this particular monastery, as I understand it. This is often the case. And the early, some of the monasteries were mixed. Some of them were some with nuns, some with monks. This one, I think, was monks. They were all, well, actually, the next most senior monk, he's really smart, he's really wise, he's going to win this. There's no point me even competing on this. So there's only one poem gets written, this other. The next most senior monk under the aging and near-to-death abbot, he writes a poem on the wall, and the translation is pretty much this. This body is a Bodhi tree, this mind a mirror bright. Hour by hour we polish them, and let no dust alight. So we've got this image of a Bodhi tree and a mirror, and just polishing it, keeping, not letting any dust fall on it. As this is our practice, this is what we're doing. And all the monks, oh, very wise, oh wow, profound, profound, keeping the mirror bright. And Huai Ning was very interested. He heard that everyone's excited about this competition. He heard down in the kitchen what was going on. He says, oh, take me to see this poem. And they tell me, what does it read? What does it say? And so another monk read it out. He said, will you write this poem beside it? And he dictated because he couldn't write. He said, and it was written up there. And the next day, the abbot came to look at the poem, said, ah, this poem is the deepest wisdom. And what did it say? It said, there is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of mirror bright. As all is void and empty, where could the dust alight? And so we can get from this that, yeah, Huai Ning, you already knew he was going to become the ancestor, so you've kind of, I spoiled the punchline really, didn't I? But yes, he wins the competition. Actually, all the monks in the monastery hate the fact that the kitchen hand has won the competition. They chase him out of the monastery, or he runs for his life with the robe and the bowl and has to start another monastery somewhere else. But that's kind of how it is in those days, it seems. Another reason why we don't do competitions. But it's interesting to contemplate, to reflect on this. There's this image we have of, okay, there's something here, we can call it the body, the Bodhi tree, the mind, the mirror bright, and we're keeping it clean, or we're clearing it, we're removing all the things that stain it, that make it dirty. That's one model. It's the purification model. It's very common in spiritual practice. Even in Buddhist context, you get this understanding or this articulation. But what the Buddha's teaching and what Huai Ning's understanding and his abbot, who recognizes his understanding, is saying something different. He's saying, yes, there is dust. There is all this. We can see greed. We can see hatred. We can see all these things going on. They are here. But there is no place which they're ultimately landing. There's no ultimate owner of these things. Now, that doesn't mean we don't need to take responsibility for them. We don't need to really take care of our actions. And we see the suffering that comes from reactivity in ourselves and others, and to learn to handle it skillfully. But to understand that it's not saying anything about what we ultimately are. Because what we are is empty. As Catherine was speaking, it's not something that becomes filled up with all of this. It's open. Empty of having inherent existence, as she said, as Catherine said last night. It's like it's not a fixed, closed, packageable location. It's a fluid, open, dynamic location that we are inhabiting. And so this idea of impurity, of needing to kind of fix or get rid of all these things from within me that seem to be causing me the suffering, is not resolved by getting rid of them all, but by understanding that while they have their reality, they don't in themselves refer to something else that we can call me, in a way that we could be said to be the owners of them, or they could be said to define what we are. They're just what's here in this moment when the conditions are so, and in a different moment when the conditions are different, they're not. So we're not this or that. But that doesn't mean we sort of disappear in a puff of sort of Buddhist logic. Poof. There's no one here. There's a, again, to refer to the Zen tradition, the sort of the beautiful sort of or classical sort of idea or image when the monk or the nun comes running in. I've understood, I've realized, it's all empty, there's nobody here. And the Zen master will usually take out their stick and give them a good thwack. Nobody there? So that's all right then, huh? Shall I do it again? No, no, there's somebody here. But not in the way we've understood or believed. There is something here. There is sensitivity. There is vulnerability here. But not in a way that we are owning, that we have an individual or separate ownership of. We have a co-participation in. So what we can also notice is that in our stories about the Buddha and our ideas and the mythology or the history and the way in which the human being gets elevated, we kind of think, wow, amazing guy, you know, what a being, can't be anything like me. But actually, if you read carefully, this enlightened and remarkable teacher, as he was, he seemed also to have some very human responses. You know, I'm always fascinated and struck by the fact that pretty much one of the first things he thought of after he awoke, after his awakening, he says, I thought, shall I share this with other people, this amazing liberation I've just discovered? Shall I share it? And his thought was, actually, if I try and explain this to people, most of them won't get it. And actually, that will be kind of annoying and frustrating and irritating for me, so I won't even bother. And you think, so the fact that some people won't get it's going to annoy this guy who's just got fully awakened and he can't be bothered? Obviously, we have to reconsider our idea of enlightenment, and if that could be the human experience. The human being hasn't disappeared. And of course, unfortunately for us, in the next moment, after that initial, resistance, aversion, or just not wanting to do it because it's going to be frustrating, compassion arose. And, oh, but there are those beings who will see. Now, classically, in the mythical version or articulation, it's like it's a being from the Brahma realm, the realm of compassion. And we've talked about the Brahma Viharas. A Brahma realm being comes and says, Buddha, you know, actually, there are those beings who will understand, who have little dust before their eyes. They will see. Teach for them. Teach for their liberation. And the Buddha thinks, okay, yeah, I'll do that. So it's an interesting story, isn't it? You know, you get fully awakened and then some people not getting it when you try and explain it is going to be annoying. And there's other situations like that where if you read the text and it's kind of a little bit more, it's sort of not articulated so obviously, but to me it's obvious. Like there's a situation where the Buddha and his two senior followers, Sariputra and Moggallana, and Sariputra is the wisest, and Moggallana has the best and most developed concentration of all his followers, so they're highly respected beings. He's with them, and a whole lot of other followers. And the other followers all chatting and, you know, being casual and arguing. And at some point he just says, I've had it with you lot. Get out of my face. To put it in modern vernacular. The text says he dismissed the retinue. He said, you know, I'm not having anything to do with you anymore. And a conversation ensues between Sariputra and Moggallana. Well, the Buddha's going to have nothing to do with them. Shall we have nothing to do with them too? That's Sariputra's view. Let's hang with them. They're lots of trouble. And, I mean, these guys are also both remarkably enlightened beings. And Moggallana says, actually, no, the Buddha's going to have nothing to do with them, but actually that means we need to take care of them now. So he takes a more sort of compassionate response. And, again, when I think of this, I think, yeah, so, you know, it's like the fully enlightened, compassionate teacher of the world finds his students annoying and tells them, you know, what comes in my mind is something like that. piss off. That doesn't come through in the, you know, the reports from that. But it does. If you read it, if you think, oh, what's happening here? Rather than just literally translate the words. What's happening here? Of course, later on, he, you know, the Sariputra and Moggallana speak to the Buddha and he decides, okay, yeah, I'll take them on again. You know. So, you know, has a happy ending, as these things tend to. So if we see that the human being that became enlightened continued to be a human being, the Buddha, and it's clearly so, then we might start to look and see the ideas we hold about me may not be any evidence that in fact what the Buddha realized could not be realized by each one of us. And this the Buddha spoke of. He said, this you can understand, this you can realize. That's why I'm teaching this. That's why I'm pointing to this. So one of the things we learn to do in practice is to see the way in which the mind tends to focus in on particulars. And we actually need to do that to see what we're doing with them. So actually, as we pay attention to particulars and we train and learn that capacity, we see this tendency to be grasping hold of or rejecting, or being disinterested and therefore disconnecting from experiences. And the way we become kind of lost and disconnected from the quality of immediacy, of presence, of wakefulness, when we get lost in the reactivity that goes with that grasping and pushing away. So the Buddha spoke of, we need to really understand that mechanism, those mechanisms, those processes, those habits of trying to pull towards and trying to push away experiences. As I said this morning, understanding that a lot of that is about the way we're trying to use or organize experience in order to provide a basis to construct a sense of self I feel comfortable with. And so there's always this, what's in it for me, or what does it mean about me, that our fascination with things entangles us with them, gives them power over us, when in fact they have very little power in and of themselves, beyond what we give to them by giving them the power to tell us who we are, what we are, or even that we are, and without which we would not trust in that, our existence indeed. So one of the things we also start to do is, as we open up and as we're able to handle, we learn the skills of handling the range of all experience. And that's really where our practice takes us. We start with the particulars and learn the skills, develop the qualities of steadiness, of kindliness, of curiosity. And then we see we can actually handle experience. We're starting to learn how to meet this, to not be carried away. And in that, we can actually start to open up the space of the attention, the awareness, the resonant sensitivity, the capacity of the chitta, the heart mind that can receive and know experience. And we see that as we do that, there's a lot more space between and after and through experience. As they arise, they equally pass. As they appear, they equally disappear. When we don't resist them or take hold of them, they're fluid. And they start to become more transparent or translucent. It's like we can sort of see that they're not as solid as we have imagined. That it's the very action or process of the grasping, the clinging, the craving and attachment to, with either desire or aversion, that makes the sense of solidity out of something that's fundamentally fluid, that makes a heaviness to something that's fundamentally light, transparent even. And so we learn to just sit back a little, to open the attention, a little as Catherine did in that exercise with the looking and focusing in, and we noticed certain things, and then opening the gaze out. That's a visual metaphor for what we can do to open the gaze out. Not just the visual gaze, but the gaze of awareness. the receptive, sensitive faculty that just knows experience, that knows life directly. And as we start to do that, we notice that all things are actually participating in something shared. They're all subject to change. They come and go. They're all unable to give us in themselves lasting satisfaction. And together with that, none of them, for exactly the same reason, are able to provide us with some kind of absolute obstacle to satisfaction. They neither can be our fulfillment in themselves, but nor can they somehow prevent fulfillment in themselves, because they're fluid and changing. They're not fixed. And we see that we can't really grasp hold of something solid in them, or in fact in ourselves, that we can fix and say, this is the core, this is the unchanging and unaffected absolute within that entity or within that object or experience. There's nothing there that we can say isn't subject to being affected by, touched by, transformed by. And so we say, that it's not self in that sense of separate, removed from. And we see that all experiences, or inherently existing, as Catherine said last night, all experience is of this character. Outer experiences, things I see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and inner experience, things that I think, things that I feel, things that I imagine or see as images internally. It's all subject to those characteristics. And in that, we start to find some more space amongst it. Because the very urge and mechanism to grasp hold of or to push away, it doesn't quite make sense when we're seeing, contemplating those dimensionalities of experience. And as we're not grasping, as we're not taking hold of so much, so quickly, so enthusiastically, as we may at other times find ourselves doing, we can start to notice something more about what's happening, which isn't to do with the particulars of the experience or the particulars of the apparent experiencer. So it's not about the subjects, the things that we think are there, or the object who is in contact with those subjects that we call me or self. There's something else that starts to be felt, perceived, palpable, that we are perhaps able to resonate with, to recognize, that is born of our willingness to include everything, to not preference one thing over another. Noticing, seeing that, of course, everything has its particular shape and form, but underlying the particularity of all things is a universality in which all things participate. And perhaps we start to get a sense of that. Perhaps we start to feel some sense of this at times in the practice, in the quiet, in the stillness, in the profound respect and dedication that we're offering each other and we're embodying in our willingness just to sit here, exquisitely still, not trying to manipulate the experience, letting go of the urge to scratch our nose or adjust the covers we've got on or the air temperature, just to see what might I discover if I let go of the urge to be adjusting the experience and just be interested in the experience and the experiencing together. The experience that we call out there, the experiencing that we think is in here. And if we start to attend to them, if we start to look at them, what we might see is that actually we can't quite separate them out. The experience and the experiencing, there isn't somewhere where the one stops and the other starts. It's just they come together. And they don't actually exist apart from that togetherness. That which is experienced and that which is experiencing. It arises together, always. This is something to contemplate, to reflect on, sometimes people will say, oh, you know, it takes thousands of lifetimes to wake up. Maybe it's true. I don't know. But on the other hand, do we know how many lifetimes we've already been engaged in this? Maybe this is actually number 100,000. Maybe this is actually the one. Really? The Buddha didn't know before he woke up how long he'd been practicing. He didn't know. He didn't have a memory of that. After he woke up, he apparently did. But before then, no. What would it mean to be open to this possibility? That this moment, that this life, that this retreat might be the place, this could be the time, these could be the conditions in which awakening blossoms in the heart, in the mind, in the human being. What if we were to just leave that possibility a tiny little bit open? Not too quick as it, nah. Just maybe. I'm not saying we have to convince ourselves. I'm not trying to talk you into it. But just to leave it a little bit open. You know, the Buddha said that we have already cried enough tears to fill the four oceans and the births and deaths of our existence, our existences. We've already had enough experience to understand the importance of letting go. Haven't we? Don't we know already that letting go doesn't harm us and that holding on doesn't serve us? Don't we know that? Not needing to get lost in a process of trying to fix ourselves, nor diverted in a vain attempt to get rid of ourselves. But we need to understand that which we call self. We need to understand it. And yet the understanding comes not necessarily by putting all our attention to the self, to the construct, to the sense, the felt experience that we have there, but equally to opening to what's happening here. What's happening? Because the self is concerned with becoming, with getting somewhere, with becoming someone, with getting something. That's what it's all about. And yet awakening is not the result of any becoming. Enlightenment is not a product born of a cause which we can develop. In fact, Trungpa Rinpoche once observed, he said, enlightenment is a great disappointment for the self, because it's the self that thinks it should get enlightened. Enlightenment is to understand the self and that which is not. Awakening is the end of becoming, of the process of tipping forward into the next moment, seeking something from it, or to become someone in it, that we imagine is not in this minute, or this moment, that we believe we are not already inhabiting in this moment. Anything we can gain, we will lose. Anyone we can become, we will cease to be. It must be so. This is the nature of things. It is the process of discovery that happens when we drop below the layer and the level that's concerned with that becoming. And we start to sense, we start to know, we start to recognize what else is here. And I say that word recognize with some real emphasis, because what's amazing, what's remarkable, and what's at the same time completely obvious that it would be so, is that what can be discovered when we discover, we go, of course. It's not, oh my gosh, I never thought of that. It's, of course. Even though it's completely new. It's like this with any insight, in fact. Any discovery you've made along your path. I'm sure you've had this interesting quality where it's like, it's new. Oh my gosh, I didn't realize, but I did. I knew all along, even though I didn't quite see it. Or see that I saw it. To wake up is to see what we've been seeing all along. The fish in the ocean who dismisses what they're floating and saying, where's the ocean? This is just water. This is just water. And I'm floating. The Buddha said, there is, friends, that condition, that base, where there is no earth, no water, no fire, no air. Not space, not consciousness, not nothingness, not perception or non-perception. Neither this world nor another world, nor both. Neither sun nor moon. Here, friends, I say there is no coming, no going. No staying, no arising or deceasing. Not fixed, not moving. It has no support. It depends on nothing else. This is the end of suffering, just this. And our mind can't do much with that. So if you notice your mind trying to try and do something with that, just give it a moment to breathe and pause. Because when our mind leans towards it, it must make it into something or nothing. Because our mind can only deal with that, anything in those terms, something or nothing. What if we were outside of that paradigm here? Not talking about something? Not talking about nothing. The mind's conceptual urge has to kind of pause there and go, There actually is a real humility of the conceiving mind because it can't really enter this territory. It's not designed for that function. But the human organism in its totality, this heart, mind, body, aliveness, it's precisely designed for this, for knowing this, for understanding this. The fundamental suffering, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, distress of life is not the difficult things we encounter. Of course, these are difficult and need attending to. But the fundamental distress is born of not understanding, not seeing clearly, a blindness and not seeing. Ignorance is the translation often used. But in fact, it's blindness, not seeing. Avidya is the word the Buddha used. To not see, both not seeing our patternings and conditionings as a particular being, as an individual, the realm of personal understanding. We need to learn about what pushes my buttons and how to free ourselves from those, the ideas and the constructions that lock us into a certain idea of me, compelled to act and react in certain ways. We need to understand that, yes. If we don't understand that, there's suffering. There's limitation. We also need to understand the realm of things, of phenomena, to see the characteristics we've talked about. Impermanence, anicca, changing, nature of things. The quality, the aspect of dukkha, of the inability to give lasting satisfaction. But I always add to that, and the inability to prevent lasting satisfaction too. That phenomena have as its qualities. It can do neither of those two things for us or to us. And that things do not exist
independently, inherently, separately by themselves, but arise in relationship to and out of a context and a matrix of interlocking conditions. Seeing these characteristics of phenomena, we have more space with them. We're less entangled by them. We understand they apply to everything we experience. And as we become less entangled with them, as our attention stops locking on to the particulars of experience, as we settle back, so to speak, this resonant human instrument starts to notice something that isn't something or nothing. Starts to vibrate, starts to recognize . And this is the realm of the unconditioned. The Buddha spoke of as the goal, the heart of the journey, to know what is as just this. Our heart's deepest longing is to know this, to not see our true nature, to not understand the universal nature of things that is awakened, the Buddha nature, we sometimes call it. To not know this is the deepest grief and loss and pain and suffering. And the loss of contact with this, the loss of the knowing of this is the core underlying loss upon which all other losses is felt as an expression of, which comes back to the loss of contact with what is at the heart of all of this. And this heart's deepest yearning to know the truth, to realize our awakened nature, to know this. This is actually from that from which everything else, in all its complications, confusions, and it seems distortions, actually emerges. At the heart of it, it's the wish to wake up. And if we look deeply, if we really settle back, and at the same time, so we're not leaning forward into the experience with our gaze, we're settling back, but we stay as interested in this as we might be, as if there was either the fulfillment of our greatest fantasies right in front of us, or the embodiment of our greatest fears right in front of us. And we would pay some attention, I expect, with either of those things. But without any of that in front of us, but to stay as interested as that, as fully present, as undistractable as that, and to see what we notice, see what speaks to us, see what we hear, what this resonant organ of sensitivity and knowing starts to receive or recognize. That which we are seeking, that which we are looking for, is what is looking, is what is seeking. When it sees itself, it's like, oh, gosh, it's a little bit embarrassing. But actually, it's mostly delightful. That which is looking and seeking is that which is being sought. That which is sought is that which is seeking. Don't try and figure it out. It won't work. But just see if it can loosen things up a little bit inside. Open things up. Because the appearance of the seeker in pursuit of that which is sought, when the non-difference of those two becomes apparent, they dissolve back into each other.
And it's clear that there was only ever this, and the separation and the suffering that appeared. That has, yes, its reality in one way we can understand it. Actually, in another sense, it never happened because they were never apart. That which we are and that which we're looking for. And then we can't help but come to rest where we are. There isn't anywhere else. There really isn't anywhere else. There isn't anything else. There's just this. Rumi says, I have lived on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons. Knocking on a door. It opens. I've been knocking from the inside. I've been knocking from the inside. And we are. And the door could open any moment if we keep knocking. So let's sit together for a few moments. So may we all, in our practice here together and in our lives, may we come to deeply trust in our human potential for awakening, freedom, and liberation. And may we allow the deepest calling of our hearts to guide us, to call us back to exactly where we begin from and where we are. May we come to know the fullness of the heart's, the sure heart's release, the deliverance of mind, that these teachings of wisdom and compassion speak to us, offer us and invite us to know ever more deeply. For our own welfare and liberation, for the welfare and the liberation of all beings. Thank you.
Again, thank you for your presence, for your practice. Please continue. If the bell could ring at 8:55, we'll have the sitting at 9:00.